So good morning, Professor Horbach. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, we'll mostly be focusing on the theme of replica symmetry breaking and its formulations, which we bound roughly from 1975, 1995, but we'll bleed a bit on both ends of that time period. And first by asking a few questions on background. So you were trained as a theoretical condensed matter physicist and largely kept on that track once you became a faculty member as well. But around, I would say, from what I can tell, around the late 60s, early 1970s, you seem to have gotten increasingly involved in actual experiments. It sort of became a larger share of your production. Is that correct? And if yes, can you walk us a bit through what led to this transition in your production and your research?
Well, first of all, I remain a theoretical physicist. When I get into my laboratory, they won't let me near the apparatus because if I touch it, it stops working. So what started it all was my work with Professor Cattell at Berkeley when I was a graduate student. I had a lot of ideas, but I couldn't find people who would actually explore them. The same is true, by the way, of Cattell himself. His own issues and interests led to very strong collaboration with experimentalists. And I guess it was in that form or format that I developed my own thoughts. So when I went to Oxford as a postdoc, I was working with the theory group, but in fact, I went most often over into the experimental wing of the Clarendon Laboratory and talked to people who were doing experiments there. And that began the close collaboration between theory and experiment, which I think marks most of my career since the early 1960s. I went to Harvard as an assistant professor, and I asked for a laboratory for just that reason. Mm. And that has been the case for my career. I've always tried to have an experimental program associated with the theoretical interests that I have. And that's true then and remained true over the years. Today, I'm a retired physicist at the University of Texas at Austin, but I still maintain a laboratory and have a research program associated with theory, but also more and more with experiment. And as we will discuss, the confluence of simulations, theory, and experiment that Giorgio really pioneered has led to what I view as an extraordinary period of productivity on complex systems dynamics.
So thank you. So would it be fair to say then that, so it's a misreading to think that you were more involved with experiments at some point? This was always both of them going in parallel, and there's not, let's say, a time where you ramped up the experimental side more than others?
Well, that depends on the eyes of the beholder. P.W. Anderson always referred to me as an experimentalist because he never liked my theory. So it depends who's looking at it. And what I try to do is to understand the subtleties of the theory and turn them into a practical experimental test. And that's indeed how I got involved in replica symmetry breaking.
So when did you first hear about spin glasses?
Oh, a long time ago. I was fascinated by the slow dynamics of complex systems. And even in my earliest years at UCLA, again, I started a laboratory. We began to look at what was then known as spin glasses and their properties. But you have to remember at that time, we didn't understand very much at all about how they behaved. So almost on my arrival at UCLA in 1963, I began work on that. And one of my first graduate students, Ralph Chamberlain, was really the first to see what we call the waiting time effect in the experiments on the thermoremanent magnetization of spin glasses. This is way back in 19 in the 60s and early 70s. But in the period that the dynamics began to unfold, we were very much involved, along with the Swedes, by the way, at Uppsala, in trying to figure out what this phenomenon was.
So I think the first couple of papers that use the word spin glasses were published in your group in 1978 with UCLA collaborators, Paul Chaikin, Ivan Schuller in particular. Do you remember how these works came about, or why did you start calling them spin glasses compared to the earlier?
That followed on our earlier work, where we really got into the dynamics of it. I don't always put my name on the papers that my students publish, because if they do the work themselves, I think they deserve to be the authors. So you won't see my name on some of those very early papers, namely the one by Chamberlain, for example. But it was in my laboratory and he was my student at that time. So what you're referring to was a continuation of that research.
Okay. In 1979, you had a collaboration with Jean Souletti at Grenoble. How did that come about? How did that work come together?
Well, because of my interest and also the wonderful work that the Magnet Lab in Grenoble had been doing, I visited the laboratory and we talked about experiments. Again, you have to remember, this is before we really understood the nature of the dynamics. And so those first two decades really were one of exploration of what was going on. We really didn't understand it. The waiting time effect, for example, which is well known in polymers and other materials, was a surprise because people had assumed that when you cooled a spin glass in a magnetic field, the magnetization stayed constant. So they said that was the equilibrium state. Mm-hmm. And that was the word that we all heard. But the problem was that it wasn't. What we found was that it depended on the amount of time that you waited before you changed the magnetic field. So it couldn't possibly be the equilibrium state. So there was a series during the early days of spin glass research where there are just a lot of wrong turns. Not because people were ignorant, it was because there simply wasn't experimental evidence that indicated that the ideas were wrong. And of course, it's become more and more fruitful as time goes on.
Do you know what interested Jean Souletti himself to this problem? I mean, did you bring this problem to him, or was he already working on spin glasses?
Well, he was already working on it. The Grenoble group had done, actually starting with Nael, had done a lot of work on dilute magnetic systems. They were really the pioneers in looking at what we call the thermoremanent magnetization. That's their words that have stayed in the literature. And so if you wanted to explore magnetism and its dynamics, you went to Grenoble.
Okay. And so this was part of a sabbatical leave, or you were just visiting through?
Every time I could get to France, I did. So it was sabbaticals, it was travel, it was conferences. I just love the way they do physics. And in fact, I spent a sabbatical year there in the early 1980s, where I worked on fractals of all things. And it was the French environment for research to me is just extraordinary. They're wonderful people to interact with and they love to argue, which is, of course, the basis of how you get progress in this field.
So the, as you were doing the these experiments on the dynamics, the first replica symmetry breaking results of Parisi appeared in 1979 and 1980. Did you pay any attention to that work at that time?
And absolutely. Everyone tried, first of all, to reproduce what he had done, which turned out to be very hard, for us anyway. And we all understood the states that he was working with. But you have to remember that Parisi's solution to the mean field result of Sherrington-Kirkpatrick was not a dynamic calculation. It was static. His so-called pure states, which are a very small subset of the total states, had infinite barriers between the states. There were no dynamics. And so, you know, we all read it and thought it was interesting, but it didn't give us really a clue as to how to translate our dynamical experiments into the language of RSB. It was really experiments that we did with the French group at Saclay in the early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s, with Michel Hamon's group, excuse me, and his colleagues, that gave us the connection. It was frustrating in a way that we had no guidance on the dynamics because there were no dynamics. But what we did was a series of temperature changes and magnetic field changes that surprisingly showed us the relationship between the statics and the dynamics. And that was published actually at a conference in 1991 in Trieste at the Theory Institute, where for the first time, we were able to relate the laboratory dynamics to Parisi's, what I would call, structure of phase space. What we found was that the symmetries that were contained in the pure states applied to the dynamical states. That is, when we looked at the energy manifold, the free energy manifold, it was self-similar. It didn't change as a function of temperature. That was astonishing. We made measurements from close to the glass temperature to half, and we kept seeing the same dynamics. Well, what other kind of system would you find where you change the temperature by that much, but the dynamics stayed the same? They slowed down, but their properties remain the same. And what we found when we did an analysis of our results was that if we made a significantly large temperature drop, the barriers diverged. And that was the first clue that, in fact, the pure states were nothing but the consequence of the dynamical states exploding in their barrier heights as you lowered the temperature. That is, the free energy barriers were not infinite, they were finite, but they all diverged. And so what we found from experiment, which later turned out to be consistent with a number of theoretical pictures, was that the phase transition for spin glasses was a continuous set of phase transitions, starting at the glass temperature and going down to as low as we could measure. That is, at every temperature, you give me a barrier height, and I will tell you the temperature at which it diverges. That means that I can tell you then how the dynamics fit in to the statics that Parisi had calculated. To me, that was the most important result we've ever received, Namely, we were able to connect the symmetry, the beautiful phase space symmetry that Parisi had developed to laboratory timescales. And that has driven us ever since 1990 in all of our experiments.
So I'd like to step back a decade or so when getting to that. I mean, you mentioned earlier your sabbatical at the ESPCI in 1981, I guess 1981-1982. Is that when you got to meet and dig in more seriously in the theoretical representation of spin glasses? And for instance, is that when you got in touch with Bernard Derrida, Gérard Toulouse, and others in the neighborhood? Or did you know them from before, or was this later?
No. It was a discovery for me. École Normale was right around the corner. And I would wander over almost daily. What was really important, in addition to my meetings at the École Normale, were the lunches. There was a little street called Pot-au-Fer, which had a little series of little restaurants. And the theorists and the experimentalists would go there almost every day for a 3-hour French lunch. But it was when ideas got thrown around that I enjoyed so much, and why I made that comment right at the beginning of this talk. It was a fascinating opportunity for me to see how different people do physics differently. But I did meet almost all of those who were involved in the early stages of spin glass theory, in particular the ultrametric symmetry, which was really invented or discovered, if you like, at École Normale by Toulouse, by the group that he worked with, which were a wonderful collection of theorists. It turns out that my major work during that year was not on spin glasses. I had been fascinated, again, because of symmetries of random systems by fractal geometry. Again, a self-similar geometry, but this time in real space. And I became fascinated by it, and a colleague of mine in Israel, Shlomo Alexander, who had worked with me closely over the years, and I began to think about how one would describe the dynamics of a fractal network. Again, dynamics versus statics. The fractal geometry, of course, from Mandelbrot on, was well known and used almost everywhere in a number of applications. But no one had ever actually done dynamics. If you had a fractal network, how would it vibrate? How would it diffuse? How would particles diffuse? And so Shlomo Alexander and I began to explore that. And then we interacted with Derrida, who had some wonderful pictures of dynamical systems that were random. And indeed, I published a paper with him during that period. But what we discovered was how to actually calculate the dynamics of fractal networks. So I focused more on that than spin glasses, though, of course, I was interested and got involved with the theory that people were working on at École Normale.
In 1984-1985, you published two PRLs on relaxation dynamics and spin glasses. And you found in one PRL that the results were in agreement with an exponential distribution of states, and the other with theories that were not related to spin glasses. How closely were you following or influenced by the theory work in your study of dynamics at that point?
Well, I had been following the theoretical developments. In particular, at the phase transition, there were some theories of Toulouse on the nature of the spin glass transition. And I had been working in that direction and We did a series of experiments to test whether the so-called Deleuze, the co-author, was correct or not. And one of those PRLs showed that, in fact, you did have both the Deleuze transition of the transverse moment, as well as the freezing of the, you had freezing of the longitudinal. You had freezing of the transverse moments, and then you had a freezing of the longitudinal. And so you went from the Deleuze transition to the Dale-Maeda thallus transition. And that was one of the PRLs. Looking at just, remember in those days, again, we didn't really understand the nature of the Spinglass transition, at least as far as I'm concerned. And so we were trying to probe it experimentally in any way we could. We didn't understand it until later that decade, where I've already made reference to the Physica paper, where we showed the connection with Parisi and the nature of the continuous set of phase transitions. But in 85, that was unknown. And so we were probing it as best we could.
At about that same time, you also, actually in 1982, you became provost of the College of Letters and Sciences at UCLA. In that position, did you ever get to the chance to tilt the scale in favor of spin glasses and or replica symmetry breaking at UCLA?
No, I kept it separate. The provost position was a new position that Chancellor Young at that time had created. It was a very powerful position because it was in charge of the College of Letters and Science, which at that time was the largest academic unit in the entire University of California complex. So I had my hands full trying to organize the college, really to bring it into the eminence that it deserved. So I was a provost, the so-called associate deans. I transitioned into full deans. We developed the power of the college. But at the same time, I continued my research. I also continued teaching freshman physics, which I enjoy. And so I felt that I could set an example of somebody going into administration, but also understanding what it was like to teach and do research at the same time. So those were 10 years where I really developed our experimental program, while at the same time I was doing administration. Didn't sleep much during those years.
but there was never the opportunity to say, try to foster sub areas of interests in that position. You were more distant.
I would never do that. Physicists, scientists, and humanists and social scientists should be completely free to choose their field of interest. No, I kept my laboratory. Actually, at the time, it wasn't very popular because spin glasses were somewhat of a loner in experiment at that time. There were only a few laboratories around the world that were involved in it. And in fact, there were some feelings that I felt that my work was really tangential to the main course of physics. Who was interested in these spin glasses anyway? We had the very fortunate opportunity to grow our own samples. So here you see again where I could actually test ideas about anisotropy, about coupling, about concentrations, about different hosts experimentally to see if I could tease out the theoretical dynamics that we were seeing.
So you're just saying that it was a pretty small group of people worldwide who were interested in this, but there was a certain concentration of interest, nevertheless, in California and in around Los Angeles in particular, Did it ever come to your to you, I mean, was this ever an idea to propose a center, say a material research center that would be focused on spin glasses, that would be centered at UCLA in particular at that time? Or
well, we had ideas of major programs, but not in spin glasses. As I said, it was a relatively viewed as a relatively narrow area. We made a number of attempts to put together a large collaborative program on the campus, but spin glasses never entered into that language.
So what were the focus then of these efforts?
Well, it was very early on, but I was also interested in systems of where you had strongly interacting electron gases. Now, of course, with ITC and everything else, they're common. But again, at that time, apart from the work at Los Alamos, people really didn't understand what happened, especially in oxide materials, to systems where you had very high susceptibilities and interacting electron gases that were certainly not Fermi-like. And so with George Gruner, who was doing spin density wave experiments, we were exploring the possibility of developing strongly coherent electron systems as a laboratory. My theoretical interests were not limited to just spin glasses, as you'll notice from the many papers.
Sure.
That you're referring to. I was also interested in paramagnetic resonance. I was interested in lattice dynamics. One of my students and I had done very early work on what we called phonon breakdown, which is now standard parametric work. But at the time, again, it was a theoretical concept that I think, to be fair, was ahead of its time.
So if we actually move forward to the 1990s, you mentioned earlier that work that was an important piece for you for understanding the relationship between dynamics and statics. Were there any other factors that rekindled your interest in spin glasses throughout the 90s?
Well, it was certainly my work with the Saclay group. When we did some work in the early 90s, it was very close collaborations where I would send a graduate student to Saclay and we would exchange samples so that they would do work on their apparatus and we'd do work on our apparatus and compare, because the results were so bizarre that I wasn't sure if they were a consequence of the apparatus or real. And so that paper that I already referred to was a result of that collaboration. I spent a lot of time at Saclay because the theory group with Bouchot and the experimental group with Vincent and Hamann were, as far as I was concerned, the best in the world in spin glasses at that time. And we worked very closely together, as a number of the publications showed. Mm-hmm. The 1991 paper with the Saclay group, with one of my students, Marcus Lederman, really at the time, I didn't appreciate its importance, but even today, we're using its results to understand rejuvenation and memory. It's just a remarkable paper that talked about the temperature dependence of the barrier heights. We had an idea, it was really Michel Hamann's idea, that the dynamics of spin glasses were controlled not by some average over all of the free energy states, but rather a specific set of free energy states associated with the very largest free energy barrier. And this, of course, resulted from the ultramatricity symmetry, where the number of states increased exponentially as the overlap between states diminished, or as we said, as the barrier heights increased. And so it was only the states at the very highest level that were giving you the dynamics. Again, a real surprise. But that meant that we could actually pinpoint a specific barrier height. And then by doing some tricks with temperature cycling, we could actually measure how that barrier height changed as a function of temperature. Now, the full paper didn't emerge until a couple of years later that I've already referred to. But it was that paper that showed that the relationship between the barrier heights and the overlap between states, remember that, because that was the basis of Parisi's analysis. Namely, he looked at the overlap Q as the operative for his calculation of the order parameter. And so we adopted the same language, again, not for pure states, but for dynamical states. And we were able then to associate in that paper the way the barrier heights changed, increased, as the overlap diminished, or as we said, as the Hamming distance, I'm sorry to be technical here, increased. The Hamming distance is nothing but a way of looking at the overlaps between the initial state and the states you're dealing with. So it was a remarkable paper because it showed that the barrier heights depended not linearly as the overlap diminished, but actually increased exponentially. That sounds a little technical, but what it has led to is our very recent work, which still hasn't been published, but was in the final stages with the Janus collaboration, where we showed that it's the basis of the breakdown of the symmetry of the dynamics of spin glasses in a finite magnetic field. This is somewhat technical, but the point is that this very early work, 1991, laid the groundwork for the dynamics that we're now probing almost to the limit of laboratory ability today.
So if I'm not mistaken, I think you also met Giorgio Parisi at that time. Is that correct? And if yes, can you tell us a bit more about how did that interaction came about and led through?
Well, I had seen Parisi at meetings. I think he put, to be honest, he put up with me because I kept asking him these questions about how you relate dynamics to pure states. He was very patient and I think incredulous, really, at our results in the early 90s, but I don't know. We listened to everything that Parisi said, and I met him at that conference I've already referred to in Trieste, and we sat down and really probed the results that we were finding with what his thoughts were. I had met him previously on a number of occasions. In those days, in the 90s, he didn't travel much. And I was so interested in what he was doing that I found there was a conference every 3 years in Andalou that was organized by the University of Trento. Andalou is a little tiny ski village in the Dolomites, just in the north of Italy. And Parisi would take his family skiing. That was always held in March. And there was still enough snow that you could ski there. And the conference would go on for a couple of weeks. And I made sure that I was there at all those conferences, because here was Parisi for 2 weeks in the same room as I. And I was able to ask him questions and probe. I had one of my students come and we sat down and worked through things with him. So I had met Parisi under this very nice informal relationship. Whether he remembers that or not, whether he thought anything about it, I have no idea. But it was the only way that I could interact with Parisi on an extended period. So I think I went to 3 or 4 of the Andalou meetings. They were held every 3 years. And they were just a wonderful opportunity, first of all, to listen to him and try and understand what he was saying, but also to interact with him in this very informal environment.
Did he by any chance visit your lab at any point?
Well, that starts my RSB experience. Yes. After I was provost for 10 years at UCLA, from 1982 to 1992, I was asked to be chancellor, that's in other language, president of a university at one of the University of California campuses, the Riverside campus. And I became chancellor there in 1992 and stayed as chancellor for 10 years. And just as I did at UCLA, I asked for a laboratory. We had in those days, the superconducting quantum interference devices, or SQUIDs, were very primitive, but they existed. And they were the most sensitive measure of magnetic moments. So that we had a SQUID, but what I asked for was a room at Riverside that was as underground as possible and away from equipment as possible. So we got the dirtiest, lowest, no window room in the physics building. And then we dug a hole in the floor and buried the SQUID in this hole. People thought we were completely nuts. But what we were doing, of course, was using the Earth to shield the SQUID from all the background radiation that you have in any building. And so I was involved I continued my research while I was chancellor. I also continued teaching freshman physics while I was chancellor. My argument was that nobody could tell me they were too busy to teach freshmen if the chancellor was teaching freshmen and doing research and being chancellor. It was in 1998 that I had my most productive interaction with Giorgio. Remember, I had met with him a number of times in Andalou and at conferences. And I don't know if he ever took me seriously, frankly, but he was very kind and very helpful. It turned out that because I knew him, and I knew that he was attending the March meeting of the American Physical Society in Los Angeles in 1998. Riverside is almost a suburb of Los Angeles. But I asked him if he would come on his way to Los Angeles and visit my laboratory. So precisely on the 14th of March at 11 o'clock in the morning, Parisi came and visited our laboratory at the University of California, Riverside. The reason I'm being so specific is that we had done a number of experiments, temperature cycling experiments, and we had data that we simply did not understand. We had piles of data looking at the dynamics and what we call the thermal remanent magnetization decay. And in particular at the magnetic field dependence, which had never been really explored before. And Parisi looked at it and said, well, it's in my paper. And I said, what do you mean? He said, it's in my paper. It's in the PRL, volume 76, page 843, 1996. I said, I read your paper in PRL and I didn't find any reference there. And he said, yes, look at equation four. And it turns out there's one sentence in that paper that I had read, but obviously not understood, that solved everything. All of the data fell onto a single line. It was one of the most incredible discoveries I've ever had the experience of. And this had to do with the correlation length in Spinglasses. Remember, up to that time, people had looked at critical exponents, both theory and experiment. They had looked at the decay and the dynamics and tried to figure out some way of understanding it. But obviously the fundamental process is the correlation length. Are the spins correlated or aren't they? And it was in that paper of 1996 that Parisi invented with his colleagues the correlation length for Spinglasses. To me, that's one of the most important papers ever written on the topic. If you do a standard correlation length, that is a two-particle correlation length, when you do the thermal averaging and the ensemble averaging, it's zero for a Spinglass. And that's because there's no magnetic ordering, obvious magnetic ordering. But if you do the four-spin correlation function, it turns out to be finite. And that was something that was in that PRL in 1996 that I hadn't picked up. It just suddenly exploded into an understanding of the dynamics. And even today, we use the correlation length as the principal probe of Spinglass dynamics. Because if you think about it, that's why Spinglasses are interesting. There is a correlation in this completely random system, spatially, that has a length scale. And it was extraordinary that he predicted it from the Green's function, as I said, equation four. And he, typical Giorgio said, it's obvious. And we said, well, thanks a lot. We just didn't appreciate the fact that the correlation length existed. Once you do that, then it's possible to think of the volume of the correlations in a Spinglass. That is, instead of something distributed over all length scales, there's actually a region, a true correlation length in this four-spin concept that describes the coupling between the spins within that length scale. And that suddenly said to us, if that's true, there must be an energy associated in a magnetic field with that volume. We call that the Zeeman energy. And that is a function of the strength of the magnetic field. But if you could somehow isolate it, you would then know the correlation length, because you can measure some way the absolute value of the Zeeman energy. And because it's related to a volume, the subtended radius of that volume is nothing but the correlation length. And so by doing that quantitatively, we could come up with a number for the number of correlated spins in a Spinglass. That has turned out, in my view, to revolutionize our understanding of Spinglass dynamics. And it all started at 11 o'clock on the 14th of March in that laboratory when Parisi came through. So RSB, or replica symmetry breaking, in my world, began at that moment. And it has turned out to be one of the most powerful tools. It also separated us from the rest of the world doing spinglass dynamics. Now, fortunately, we had interactions with the Saclay group. And so they were working, we were working on a metallic system, namely copper manganese and silver manganese. They were working on a spinel system, an insulating system. And we said, if it's true in ours, is it true in yours? And this became the first evidence that there was a universality associated with spin glasses, that it didn't depend on the nature or the length scale of the coupling, because obviously in a metal, it's much longer than what it would be for super exchange in a insulator. And so they then did the same set of experiments on their sample. We then exchanged samples because we weren't sure whether, we remember, this was all first stuff. We didn't know whether we were right or not. And the PhysRev letter that we published in 1999, titled Extraction of the Spinglass Correlation, was joint with the Saclay group. That's PRL 82, page 438.
Yes. I have it.
To me, that was the monumental achievement that Parisi had generated. And it has served us very well ever since then.
So
RSB started in my laboratory at the 14th of March at 11 o'clock in 1998.
So as you mentioned before, in recent years, you've been collaborating quite closely with the Janus group on a mix of simulations, experiments, and theory. Can you tell us a bit how that came about, or does it directly flow from these late 90s experiments?
Yeah, it actually was unknown at that time. Excuse me. Parisi, in his Nobel lecture, refers to the importance of simulations and how they interface with theory to give you a picture of things that you just simply can't calculate analytically. And up to about the mid-teens, maybe 2012, 2013, the simulation groups had been looking at statics and critical exponents and so on, beautiful set of experiments. And it occurred to me that they had the power of actually looking at the correlation link. They could actually, they had the wave function. They could actually write down the nature of the spins, and from that determine, they now call it the micro correlation link, determine the actual correlation link as a function of temperature. Now, what happened in the Janus collaboration was there was a Janus 1 and a Janus 2. The Janus 2 was much more powerful. And they began to look at dynamics associated with the growth law of spin glasses. It was roughly at that time that I sent an email or somehow contacted Victor Martin-Mayor in Madrid about their simulations, asking if they could do some simulations for some of the things we were measuring. And he was very kind. And it turned out that he was working with a colleague at the University of Southern California. And so he came by on his way back to Madrid. This is when I was in Austin. in the mid-teens, and stopped by, and we just hit it off, I think, wonderfully, and began our collaboration at that point. We began then to do experiments which would overlap with what they could simulate. In our first couple of papers, we looked at, again at the correlation length, and we began to work back and forth. We had Skype, which was pretty primitive, but there it was, and emails and visits and so on. And just to give you an example, one of the things that they found when they actually looked at the correlation length, was that as the correlation length increased, the growth slowed down. That was a bizarre result. And so the question was, is that true? I mean, you do one thing in simulations, what happens in the experiment? Well, because we had a very patient graduate student, these experiments take weeks. When you talk about long times, spin glasses are very slow. We were able to get the longest correlation lengths ever seen in a spin glass. And the reason was that we were able to collaborate with a wonderful crystal grower. Her name is Devo Schlegel at Ames Laboratory in Iowa State University. And she was able to grow single crystals of spin glasses. So here you see how the simulations drove the experiments literally from the ground. Namely, if you use a polycrystal, which everybody, literally everybody, had done up to that time, you had crystal boundaries. You had crystallite boundaries. And so what happened to the correlation length as it grew? It stopped. It was interfered with by the crystallite boundaries. It's a subtle point, because copper is very good at transmitting electricity, but not very good at spin glass correlations, because the Rudin-Cattell interaction transitions from oscillatory to exponential when you have scattering. And of course, crystallite boundaries scatter. And so even though the conductivity is high, it doesn't mean that the correlation length can grow. Again, a very subtle but important point. So we worked with Schlegel to see if she could grow single crystals where we wouldn't have that problem, so we could test Victor's, or I should say the Janus collaboration results. She was able to do that. We now have a collection of single crystals, which are just gold. I mean, it's a gold mine. We can do things that nobody else has ever been able to do. And we were able to get correlation lengths as large as a tenth of a micron. I mean, normally people in glasses think of length scales of 20 angstroms. 30 angstroms is big. Here we were talking about 1,000 angstroms. And sure enough, we found that the growth of the correlation length slowed down as the size of the correlated regions increased. That was an extraordinary example, to me anyway, of how the simulations drove experiments and led to an understanding of what was going on. And since then, we've done a number of experiments that have really used the correlation length as our microscopic probe. And Victor and I now are in very close contact, along with the rest of the Janus collaboration, to really probe, using the correlation length, the dynamics of spin glasses.
In your interview at the AIP, you mentioned your vision for the importance of computational science already in the early 2000s, but I don't think you've ever led computer simulations yourself. So where does your appreciation for the for the method or the approach come from?
Well, it all started actually in 2002. I had left the chancellorship at Riverside and went to the Department of Energy as the director of the Office of Science. And the Office of Science supports more physical science research in the United States than any other agency, including the NSF. It spans really the entirety of the physical sciences and the biological sciences. I have to say this, it was the DOE that found that you could use computers to determine the structure of DNA, not the NIH. And it's just a wonderful organization that uses power of computation for many purposes, obviously for the development of nuclear weapons, which was the prime driver. But the Office of Science supports research that's not classified across the country. And at that time, the Earth Simulator in Japan had just released its results, which showed that, first of all, they could run circles around anything that we had. And they did calculations of climate change that were the most advanced in the world at that time. And so I asked people at DOE, why aren't we doing that? And they said, well, we have faster computers. It turned out we did have faster computers, but only at LINPACK speed. And in particular, they were very inefficient at actually doing real calculations. The efficiency of the Earth simulator was of the order of 25% to 40%. Ours was less than 8%. And that was because we used commodity chips. Our whole approach was to cheapen the cost of the computers. They used, the Japanese used vector chips. We used scalar chips. It was clear there was something wrong in the United States. And so I started it. The Office of Science, a major initiative in high-end computing. And out of that, it became clear that high-end computing had a huge role to play in basic science and also in industry, because one could simulate, for example, the airfoils associated with airplanes. And instead of building little models, which are very expensive, in wind tunnels, you could actually simulate them on a computer if you had enough speed. And it's just very nice. But yesterday, Oak Ridge formally announced the exaflop scale of their computer, which I got to tell you, in those days, I didn't even know what the word meant. So far beyond anything that we were talking about teraflops as our goal. But that started high-end computing and simulations in my mind. The following year, we issued the 20-year facilities outlook for the Office of Science. And number two was high-end computing. Now, nobody had thought about computing as a facility. It was okay, it was expensive and you did it, but a facility? And the reason that's important is it gives you a planning track. It gives you the ability over time to start investing in faster and faster machines. And towards the end of my stay at the Office of Science in 2008, we realized that an exaflop was feasible. And we started, and I mean, people thought we must have been out of our mind, workshops to figure out what could you do at an exaflop. And yesterday, it became a reality. It'll be on, they're testing it now, but it'll be on track for users in September of this year. And there's just such an exciting role for simulations that can now be undertaken, both in industry and in research in the public sector. That was another thing that was very important when you talk about simulations. The computers at DOE, when I got there, were only available to those who had DOE grants. And my first question was, why? Everybody pays income tax or taxes in the United States. Why, that funds these computers, why are we limiting access? It's a tradition. Well, I didn't think that tradition made any sense. So one of the first things we did was to open up the computers to the private sector. And we said, you will get free time, no charge, but you will have to compete for time on the basis of the quality of your research with those who are involved in universities and institutes and so on. And one of the first successes was Procter & Gamble. And I use this because most people have forgotten what their babies were like. But the first use was diapers. Now you're going to say, why are diapers in need of simulations? Diapers are very sophisticated. They can't leak, but they also have to wick away the moisture from the baby. That's a non-trivial diffusion problem. And it turned out that the people at who were working on the subject understood that and had been working on laptops. Anyway, they succeeded, and I like to think that the quality of diapers is due to high-end computing simulations. Not sure everybody recognizes that. And on and on. So simulations were the meat that you could get from these high-end computations. Now, obviously the Janus collaboration is a special built computer just for spin glasses, for Ising spin glasses, but there it is. And so even during the time I was in DOE, we were exploring the possibility of simulations, but it wasn't until I was actively involved with Victor in the mid-teens that it really became serious. Now we have a interaction which is literally daily between ourselves in the laboratory and our theory and the simulators on spin glasses in Madrid and Rome.
In that same oral history, you also express a certain interest for the physics of structural glasses, right? Of glasses. Have you followed development in that field over the years, or this was just a comment in passing?
No, we followed it very closely. And so, by the way, has Giorgio. He's had a number of papers about structural glasses. Excuse me. And their dynamics. The real breakthrough, as far as I'm concerned, was from a group in Orsay led by Ladeux, L-A-D-I-E-U-X, who looked at the higher order dielectric constants. This was about 4 or 5 years ago and continues today, of structural glasses, in particular of glass-forming liquids. So you got to think of a glass former as you lower the temperature. It slows down ever more slowly, rapidly, I should say, but the dynamics slow down very rapidly. And you get what's called the glass transition, which simply means that the dynamics are longer than any laboratory timescale. So what you want to do is you want to look at glass forming liquids as you lower their temperature. And what he did, in a series of beautiful experiments, was to look at the third and the fifth order dielectric constant. Now, the reason for that is that if you think of a correlation length in glasses, it may be there in the third order dielectric constant, which diverges. But the correlation length plays a different role, different power, in the fifth order than it does in the third order. And so by dividing the fifth order by the third order, you actually project out the correlation length in a glass-forming liquid. And lo and behold, they found that a correlation length existed. This was a huge observation because people had argued for years that it's nothing but a random first order phase transition, RFUD it's called. And it wasn't clear whether there was a correlation length or not, whether it made any sense. And now through Ledoux's experiments, or analysis actually, and experiments that we know there is a connection. Now, beyond that, I don't know where the field stands right now. But to me, it means there is a link between spin glasses and structural glasses in the sense that they're both random, they're both slow, and they both exhibit a correlation length that diverges at some point. We know ours diverges at the critical temperature. Where does the glass transition correlation length diverge? Is it at this lower temperature? I'm sorry, I just blanked out on the name.
The Kaltzmann.
Will come, or it, you know, where is it? Is it at zero temperature? The Kaufman.
Yes.
Is it at the Kaufman temperature? Or is it at zero temperature? Nobody knows, but they're probing it. And who knows? We'll see.
So were you in contact or aware of the work of, let's say, Dan Kievelson at UCLA in the 80s when they were working on structural glasses, or was this too far afield?
I really wasn't aware. We had worked on glassy-like materials at UCLA in those days. I had a student who was looking at superionic conductors, and we were doing work on diffusion in one dimension. But it was, we had not really, remember, those are the 80s. We didn't know about correlation lengths. To me, it's very nice to do critical exponents and static numbers, but to me, dynamics are everything. And that's what I was interested in. And so it wasn't until we were really able to get the correlation length out in the late 90s that suddenly everything opened up for both systems.
From your position of having bridged between across the Atlantic and having held fairly high level positions in administration for the administration of science, I should say, in the US, what do you think are the differences between the US and the European engagement with spin glass and replica symmetry breaking ideas?
Well, first of all, RSB is not limited to spin glasses. And there's a lot of work now in the States on optimization problems, quantum optimization, which is all based one way or another on spin glass dynamics. And as the Nobel citation indicated, it's everywhere, I mean, all over physics. So there's a huge amount of interest. In terms of spin glasses themselves, there are some laboratories, excuse me, in the States that are working on this. I'm working, for example, with some colleagues, sorry, in Minnesota and in Pennsylvania, two different universities on spin glass dynamics. there are other programs, as I said, looking at the equivalent of stained glass dynamics in these other fields. There's even a sociological paper that uses RSB. The one beautiful thing about Parisi has accomplished is its incredible importance across not only science, but social science and fields of that sort. Now in Europe, the Saclay group has more or less moved on, and so has the Swedish group. I think, frankly, I know that Vincent and Amana both retired. Europe has this unfortunate requirement that when one reaches 65, one has to retire. When I was a young kid at the university and they lifted the requirement age in the United States, I was furious. I thought, oh goodness, people can stay on forever. Now that I'm well beyond 65, I think it's the best thing that ever happened. We get a number of our best faculty here at the University of Texas from Europe because they don't want to retire at 65. John Goodenough, who just got the Nobel Prize, is from Oxford and was told he would have to retire in 2 years, and so came to the University of Texas. So we profit greatly from the forced retirement in Europe. What that means is that the group in Uppsala, which has been so productive, and also the Saclay group, have more or less finished. And there isn't, to my knowledge, an active European experimental program currently in existence. That may be unfair. I've already given you an example of an experimental group on structural glasses. But in the literature anyway, in terms of our work with the simulators, they're really beyond Minnesota and Pennsylvania, and of course, Iowa. There isn't anybody else that's active in the field that I know of. There are spin glass papers that appear from time to time, from India, from Europe, and from other sources. And they're interesting and important, but they don't focus where we're looking, mainly at this interaction between simulations and experiments that's proven so vital.
At UCLA, at Irvine, or elsewhere, did you ever teach about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail?
Well, the amusing thing is, first of all, not Irvine, but Riverside.
Riverside. Yeah, my mistake.
That's okay. People make that mistake a lot. I actually did give a series of lectures on spin glasses and at various universities, but never a course or a book. I have in the back of my mind writing a book on spin glasses because I think, frankly, our laboratory has a unique perspective on it. The difficulty is I don't understand them. And so it's hard to write a book about something you don't understand. And in particular, what has eluded almost half a century of research is the origin of rejuvenation and memory. These are not unknown in other systems, in polymers, for example. But in spin glasses, you're able to actually get down to the microscopics. And so what are the microscopics of rejuvenation? Just for the record, let me describe what they are. If you cool a spin glass to a temperature below the freezing temperature and you wait, the system works towards equilibrium and the susceptibility diminishes. the dynamic susceptibility. If you continue to lower the temperature, of all things, it goes back to what it would have been had you not waited. That's called rejuvenation, and we now believe it's due to chaos, so-called temperature chaos. And literally this year, we published our first paper on experimental paper on temperature chaos. There are only two papers in the literature, one in 2004 and one in 2022, and ours is the latter. Okay, that's fine. But what happens is that when you then warm up to where you started, the system remembers the equilibrium state in which you left it. Now, how can that be? You've gone chaotic, and yet you come back, and it remembers. That's called memory. And that has bedeviled scientists for at least 20 years, if not longer. And we now think we understand it. And of course, it's based on the correlation link. If that understanding holds, I'm finally able to write my book because I think I will then finally understand the dynamics. It's a little bit like the Gilbert and Sullivan song. When I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery, it's when I know enough about spin glasses that I can write a book about it. That I'll start. So that's where I stand right now. Whether I'll live long enough to do that is another matter, but it looks promising.
Anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
I don't think you've overlooked anything. I would just like to reiterate the remarkable scientific importance of the interaction between experiment theory and simulations. I've never seen anything like it, where one will guide the other and vice versa, and surprises that pop up, and where one, we did some experiments that in memory, for example, they hadn't seen it in the simulations, they looked more closely and they saw it. It's driving both to a fundamental understanding. The importance of theory is important because this all takes place in a theoretical framework. But nevertheless, to be able to understand the physics behind the dynamics is what it's all about. To me, that's what physics is about. And this wonderful interaction, I think, is an example beyond comparison of the fruits of such an interaction.
As a final question, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan or an intention to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I really don't. My archives are the published papers, and I'm just leaving it at that. I've never wanted to spend time putting together notes and so on, because the theory and experiment were so exciting, I wanted to do that first. So I've never had the patience to do that. I have a set of lecture notes on fractal dynamics that I gave when I was a Lorentz professor at the University of Leiden, which just begs to be a book. I'd be delighted to deposit it, but that was in the days when everything was handwritten and on view graphs, if you remember those days. I wouldn't know where to deposit it either. The papers are what speaks for themselves.
So no email correspondence even, or paper correspondence that you've kept over the years? Yeah.
No.
Thank you very much for your time and for this conversation.
Well, Patrick, thank you for your patience, and I hope this has been useful.